Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Eden.
Hello, thanks for coming. Thank you, Barbara. Woman number 17 is, we were just joking about how do you quickly summarize something without your eyes glassing over. It's the story of two women. One is a woman named Lady, and she's in her early 40s. She has two children. Her son Seth is 18, and he doesn't speak, and he never has. And she has a two-year-old son, and she's recently kicked out her husband, the father of the two-year-old son, and she's living with her two kids high in the Hollywood Hills in the house that her husband bought her. And she's on deadline to write a memoir based on raising her son Seth. It's supposed to be like a mothering memoir, an inspiring tale of being a parent of a child with a disability. But she's pretty much a wreck, and she's living a lie. And this memoir is bringing up a lot of old pain for her. And she hires a nanny to live in the guest house out back and take care of Devin, her son, her younger son, so she can write this memoir. And she and S, Lady and S, immediately have this connection and this rapport. But it turns out that S actually isn't exactly who she seems. Her real name is Esther, and she's doing this strange performance project that Lady doesn't know about, where she's becoming the 22-year-old version of her own mother, who's an unstable but lovable alcoholic. So it's about what happened to them at the end of a summer in L.A. And you have to read it to find out.
And Shanti?
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here. So this is Lucky Boy, my novel. And just to give you a quick sketch, so Lucky Boy follows two stories. Lucky Boy follows two stories, and the first side of the story is this woman named Soli. She's a young woman. She's about 18, 19. She's from the Oaxaca region of Mexico, and she makes the journey up through Mexico across the border and ends up in Berkeley, California, of all places. And she's undocumented, so she's here without papers, and she gets a job as like a daily housekeeper for a Berkeley family in the gourmet ghetto. And so we follow her story. She ends up having a baby as well. And then the other side of this is a Berkeley couple named Kavya and Rishi. They're Indian American, and they've been trying to have children. They can't have children. You know, they live one of these classically beautiful Berkeley lives. And their main struggle is around having a child. So the two sides of this narrative come together over the fate of Soli's little boy. And I'll leave it at that.
And I'm sure we'll hear more about these three books and books that our authors have written before as we dive into the topic here. So I'm going to start by playing the devil's advocate. The world is falling apart. It's a giant mess. Syria, the environment, the Middle East as a whole, healthcare. Why the hell should we talk about love? Anybody?
It seems to me that this is the very reason to talk about love at all. I think it's sometimes easy to forget that love is in the world when you look at the news or you go on Twitter. So for me, I actually need to read novels to reaffirm my own humanity and the humanity of everyone around me, including the people whom I disagree with.
I would agree with that. And I would add that sometimes it can seem indulgent to be exploring one's inner life. But I think if you're happy and strong in your relations with the people you love, you'll be better able to take on the things in the world that are upsetting, which are legion at the moment. So if you're in a fundamentally brittle and uncertain place, it's very hard to know how to move forward with helping heal the many breaks in the world.
Mm-hmm. I feel like right now we have to spend so much mental energy analyzing things and second-guessing what we hear and see and are told and being necessarily cynical quite often, that it's important to have love, because love is so not cynical. You know, it's primal and it's basic, and it's one of those things that we need to counterbalance everything else that's out there.
And I would just sort of enlarge that as somebody who's been in a book club for 30 years, the same book club, which is amazing, reading exclusively fiction, reading the larger question, because so many people say to me now, I can only read nonfiction because I have to rah, rah, rah. I do think, and I'd love your take on this, that reading well-written fiction really opens us up to understanding the human condition, which is really what all of this depends on.
Agreed. I think for me, reading and writing about complicated people with very complicated desires, people who are pulled in all kinds of directions and whom you may identify with sometimes and sometimes cringe at their behavior, that for me is a empathic muscle that I think we all need to flex regularly. And it does enable me to kind of understand where other people are coming from. And I may disagree with them, but to sort of think about how everybody, you hope, every American is moving from a place of trying to negotiate their own personal life. And if I come to the day with that feeling, I can get through the day more easily. Where if I just think about how everyone is sort of a flawed creature who loves and wants to love, it makes it somehow easier to connect with people I otherwise might think as reprehensible humans otherwise. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point, that reading fiction, as you say, it sort of encourages and inspires our empathy. And also, I think when you read a novel that you connect with, you obviously reflect on your own life and hopefully with ways that your life decisions intersect with those of the characters, or the characters' decisions, even if they're very different from yours, inspire you to reflect on choices that are ahead of you. And that to me, that act of reflection, like the exercise of empathy, the act of reflection is something that we need very much, you know, in looking at our wider world also, decisions we're making as citizens, you know, mm-hmm. and as a nation also.
And you both mentioned empathy, and we had a brief email conversation in preparation for this panel talking about some of the themes that might emerge. I think it was you, Sylvia, correct me if I'm wrong, but you said something about the necessity for authors to care about their characters, or was that you, Eden? Their characters and love them in spite of their flaws, mm-hmm. and that's a question of empathy. And so can you talk a little bit about that as a novelist, all
sure.
of you?
Maybe I'm thinking about this because it seems that even people who really love Woman Number 17, I keep hearing, like somebody was like, every single character is so unlikable. Mm-hmm. And I have this issue with that term, because I feel like, well, I find them... likability or unlikability is not really where my focus is. It's more like, are these people believable? Are they captivating is sort of my question. And I do think you have to love your characters. First of all, you're going to spend years around them. So you have to want to be around them. But you have to find their inner lives worthy of so much page space. And so I have sort of taken... My duty as a writer is to love them and to have compassion for them and to try to figure out why I have these characters do what they do. You know, I have, especially in this book, I have people making a lot of bad decisions, and I think that's kind of fun to read, honestly. But I also am interested in why people do what they do and why you might not be able to be the best parent, or why you might kick out your husband when he seems like such a great guy. All the things that my characters do, or why somebody would embark on this kind of deceitful art project. I'm really interested in those questions of what makes... I'm sort of just obsessed with why people... it's almost like they work against their own interests. They kind of mess up their own lives just to mess them up, or because they have inherited certain dysfunctions from their own family. And I just... That's what I love about people. I just think people are weird and strange, and we need to value that and love that about ourselves. Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the great gifts of being a writer, is that you train yourself to look inside at people's stories. You don't just, you know, if you see someone on the news, you don't take them at face value. You don't take them just for what they're saying. You actually think about what's gone into their lives and what has brought them to the place where they are.
It's interesting. Also, so this book was a few years in the writing, and certain parts of the story came more readily, and other parts of the story I had to dig more deeply to make those sections more complete. And one of the efforts of that digging was to fill out a character who was further from me initially. You know, of course, it's a little bit easier to be close to the characters you can understand better. And so one of the interesting processes of working on the novel, in a way, is evolving your own capacity to see, as you say, somebody who initially seems, you know, less sympathetic, or understand why they're doing what they're doing, or be able to present the different sides of an argument, the different sides of a marriage that's failing or has difficulties. And that's important, and it's a great thing about being a writer, is you get to sort of learn yourself.
Zadie Smith I always quote this. I trot it out at every panel. But Zadie Smith, in this old Bookworm interview she gave, talked about how fiction provides a high... I also like how it sounds. She said fiction provides a hypothetical, ethical arena. Mm-hmm. And I love that. One, it's why reading is so fun. You get to lead all these different lives and see what this person's going to do in this particular situation. But then as a writer, you get to do that as well. You put these characters in these risky, possibly emotionally dangerous situations, and then you see what they do. And I think if you really are loving your characters, you will kind of allow them to go into those hypothetical, ethical arenas and see what happens. Let them make those poor choices.
I just want to interject, talking about likable characters. I don't know if any of you followed, and you might look it up. Claire Massoud, the novelist, started a really interesting discussion several years ago. Mm-hmm. I think there was a review that said her characters weren't likable. Yep. It might have been The Woman Upstairs. I can't remember.
That's right.
Did any of you follow that? It was really...
I don't know if you want to... She made the excellent point that that's a question not asked of, for example, Philip Roth very often, you know, and it is to some degree a pretty gendered question, that I think many women writers, unless they're writing about the not very interesting fictionally characters who are flawless, you know, we often encounter, oh, but she seems so angry, oh, but she's not a perfect mother, oh, but she's not the most sweet wife all the time.
So jumping into the question of love, and we're going to get at it from a lot of different places, and please feel free when you ask questions, which there will be an opportunity for, to skirt as widely around this as you like, because we're talking about everything. But I want to start with you, Shanti, in talking about a very specific kind of love, the original love, which is mother love, because that's really what's at the heart of your novel. So... take that on however you like.
Yeah, so there's a lot of maternal love and ferocity in this novel. One thing that I had to really think about was those first crucial days after a baby is born. And I have two kids myself, so it didn't take a huge leap of imagination. And I actually went back to some of my old writing right after my first son was born. I was sort of flooded with like all these observations. It was, you know, it's one of these heightened experiences that you just have never had before. And so I wrote a lot about what my son looked like and what I was afraid of, and, you know, how he was like sort of this baby. And sometimes he looked male, sometimes he looked female. It was like this ethereal being. But for my character, Soli, you know, I had to really think about those first days for her. And it felt almost like love wasn't even a real word when it comes to motherhood. Like, I think I write love as a television word. It's one of those terms that we stick onto what mothers feel, but it's so much more than that. It's, you know, there are like 50 adjectives that should be just in that German way, just put together and made into one big adjective to describe what it is to love a child. And then for Kavya, on the other side, you know, she can't have a child. She's been trying and trying, and she can't conceive. And so that's love that is tinged with loss. It's love that you know, has another dimension, another shadow to it altogether.
And yearning. Yeah.
And yearning.
Yeah. And Eden, you have a different kind of mother relationship, somewhat corrupted.
I have a really nice mom. I just want you guys all to know. I agree, this feeling of when you have your first child and there's just this... we need a German word. That's a good way to put it. I'm interested in all the very complicated feelings that we can have towards our children and the feelings that our children can have towards us. So in my book, Lady's the mother of two, but she has a really fraught relationship with Seth, who's 18, and he has mutism. She has this deep love for her son, and I hope that that's clear to the readers. And yet she hasn't really done right by him. She's still pining after his father, who abandoned them when Seth was a baby. She's kind of kept them isolated and hasn't really found him all the services that she could have found him, perhaps. And she, I think, has a hard time loving her second son, Devin, as much as she would be able to. It's almost, I think, deep down that she feels guilty that Devin can speak when Seth can't, and that she can't love him totally because that would be to love the able-bodied child and the child compared to the complicated feelings she had for the disabled child. But she also had a really rough relationship with her mother, whom she hasn't spoken to since Seth was a baby. So she has that wound that's never healed. And I think the fact that she doesn't have a tender mother has hurt her. Often as a parent, I think parenting is so hard that if I didn't have good examples, I would be like up Schitt's Creek. Like the fact that I can call my mother and ask her questions, and that I can call upon memories of my parents and how they dealt with me enables me to be a good parent, I think. And I think about people who don't have that privilege, and I've thought about that a lot. Conversely, who's Esther, the artist. She's a recent Berkeley graduate, and like a lot of young people, she doesn't quite know who she is, and she's looking to her parents to understand herself. And so what better way to understand yourself than to try to literally become your own mother through art? And I think she, you know, I wanted to not only talk about the act of mothering, but also being mothered. And, you know, Lady is struggling with her own mother, her mom rage, as it were. And S also is trying to figure out, if I can understand my mother, maybe I can understand why she's like the way she is. And she's kind of lived her whole life kind of sort of taking care of her mother, or she's sort of parentified with her. And I just wanted to get at all these very different kinds of mothering and mothered relationships, and the very how it's not just one thing. Like, when you have a baby, yes, there's that intense protective love. I also think there's this like, oh my God, what did I do moment when you have that newborn in the middle of the night and you're like, stop crying, what are you doing? I think there's all these feelings that come up, this intense fear that the world is so dangerous and you're the only thing keeping this child safe. I mean, there's all of those feelings. And I just wanted to have a book that really got at everything and not flinch from them.
It's great to hear you both speak about maternal love and in the many different dimensions it has. It seems that that's something that's common in all of these stories. One of my characters, Anne, has chosen not to have children, and her work life is more central to her existence. And Flannery is somebody who did choose to have a child. And so for Flannery, she's in her late 30s, and she had this very passionate relation in college with Anne. And that relationship, even though it was very brief, and it was really a college, you know, the kind of the first college passion, it's remained in her mind and in her heart, this very pure experience she had, and her purest sense of what love is. She's gone on to have other relationships. She then met a man who she's married, who she loves, and has a daughter with him. But the focus of her love is not the marital love in her life. And when her daughter is born, there's the scene for her. Her daughter's name is Willa, and I think there's a line, with Willa was born light. And there's just a light that comes to her with the birth of her daughter. And although this is complicated territory, the only time to connect romantic love with maternal love is obviously a complicated link to make, but she can see that it's the same place within her that is illuminated by her daughter. And so when she later meets Anne again, there's this complexity of there being these two different people in her life who obviously she has a different kind of love for, but becoming a mother for Flannery is a way of re-experiencing a purity. Not that it's not mm-hmm. complicated by impatience and frustration, and it's, you know, this is not some sort of glowingly perfect maternal model, but just that part of herself seems sort of to be a light when her daughter is with her.
It's interesting, Sylvia. There's a same-sex relationship at the heart of your novel, but it doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't matter. And as the writer writing about two women and their love for one another, can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, I know we're in Berkeley and we're all very progressive and we get it, but...
Yeah, you all get it, so I obviously don't need to talk about it. No, it's interesting. I the first book as well, I didn't... however to say it, I didn't foreground the fact that it was two women in love. To me, and what was quite gratifying in the case of the first book, Pages for You, when that was published, for some reason I did find a special pleasure in having notes from, you know, both straight and straight male readers, you know, saying that I had exactly the same experience. There was this hilarious letter I got from a man who must have been in his 50s or 60s. The story is set at a thinly described Yale University, which is where I went. And so this other, you know, old Yale guy wrote me a letter saying, I had the same experience. Her eyes were blue, not green. Her hair was brown, not red, but her mouth was the same. I was like, wow, I really touched that reader. that's important to me, that, you know, love is, you know, as cliched as it is, that love is universal. So what's more important to me than that she's, that Flannery is now married to a man and is, you know, wondering about this woman in her life is more just what it's like to have a love from an earlier self, the mm-hmm. self you were when you were in your late teens, because a lot of us leave that self rather far behind.
And I just want to say to the men in the room, thank you for being here. We do have three women up here, and we're talking about mothers, not fathers, and same-sex love with women, but men are totally included, and we don't want to make that mistake, so just saying that. Anybody else on same-sex or... Because I want to.
The other sex.
The ferocity of love. So the title of this panel is The Ferocity of Love. And what is it about love that can make us ferocious, or as one of you said in our conversation, beast-like, and take us out of our normal, civilized human discourse? I mean, because you want to get at that in what you're writing mm-hmm. to communicate the passion and the intensity. So I wonder if any of you have given any thought to that or...
Yeah, I had to, access the sort of the beastly side of love where you let the shackles of intellectual rationality and, you know, I shouldn't do this, like those thoughts fall away. In this book, Soli does something for her son that, you know, it's like no logical person would do, but it happens in the book. And I had to write the book in such a way that by the end, when she does this thing that she does, it makes sense to the reader. It's not this big sort of atom bomb that seems to come out of nowhere. So I think when we love something, anything, romantic, maternal, paternal, whatever, we go to a deeper place than the human place. We go to sort of an animal place. You know, we access the beast in us for better and worse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just want to add, in your book very much is a political issue that's on the front burner today about undocumented people coming into the country, especially here in California. And can you talk a little bit about sort of mixing that very important social issue and the sense I get of this injustice with a love story?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the social issue of undocumented immigration and the story of parental love, these did not seem like such disparate entities to me. These seemed pretty easily intertwined because as I see it, the people who are crossing the border, the people who are coming undocumented into the United States, they are mothers and they're fathers, and you know, they have loves that they've left behind back home. So that love, you know, even though this is a political issue, that love informs every step that they take. You know, so often they make this journey for their family, not for their own entertainment, you know, not because they want some glamorous new life. It's because they need to do something for their families. And mm-hmm. So there's love at the root of that movement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As I was thinking about this conversation, I decided to reread a really old-fashioned love story. So I reread Jane Eyre, which I hadn't read in a really long time. And it was great, by the way, mostly because I forget everything, so it was new. So that was pretty cool. But I was thinking about some of these classic love stories that we all know and love, and wondering whether there's an old-fashioned way of writing about love, and then coming up to right now today, in the recent past, we've had these very widely acclaimed unreliable narrator stories, like a Gone Girl, for example, or the girl on the train, or something like that. So I'd like all of you to take a stab at writing about love now versus those novels that are the classics, the ones we grew up on, the ones that we love, for better or for worse.
Mm-hmm. I wrote for The Millions, which is a literary website, on one. I reread Jane Eyre.
Oh.
This was probably one of my evergreen pieces, because people always comment on it irately, because I wrote this list that was Mr. Rochester is a Creep, a list. Because when I reread it, I was like, this is crazy. I'm going to marry you, but actually my old wife is in the attic. And he dresses up as a woman and pretends he's the fortune teller. It's kind of messed up. And like, they're both supposed to be ugly. Like, there's all these interesting things. And I actually think that's a less conventional narrative than we recall.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a side. But I always get comments to this day. I'm like, this was published in like 2007, you guys. They're like, Mr. Rochester is the best romantic lead ever. How dare you? People get very passionate about it.
We were talking about Kathy and Heathcliff earlier.
That is effed up too.
Good.
But I feel that Heathcliff and Rochester sort of merge in people's readerly memories. Yeah. Or I should speak for myself. Rochester and Heath, you know, dark,
mysterious, brooding,
possibly not fully honest, but you know, compelling.
Sexy.
Ted Hughes. It's all sort of all stuff in there.
I do wonder. I mean, and those narratives are predicated on the fact that that was when marriage was turning into something that was, you know, those are about romantic love in a time when marriage was often not about romance and not about love, but about land. And you were married, and then you were married. That was the end, right? The marriage plot ends with the marriage. And I think now, where we have so many options, and you can have a love affair that doesn't end in anything, but you have to give somebody back their, like, what do you, I don't know, their iPod. I don't know. But I think the fact that these narratives now can, it's almost like there's less at stake in terms of people's good name, as it were, mm-hmm. or their money, the landed gentry. It's not about that anymore. And so we can get more into that sort of beastly, that which transcends any of the social stuff, or how the social enters, how the political enters the private. I think that's really where our love stories are evolving. And I think the fact that we can write about sex in a way that the original stories could not, I think that changes the narrative quite a bit.
I want to get into that, but in what you were saying, I was thinking of Edith Wharton and Lily Bart, mm-hmm. who had just no agency.
Right.
And women have so much more agency now, but Sylvia, go ahead.
I was just going to say, the other side of our modern opportunities and our freedom to write more, you know, about whatever we want, really, and I think is that, and this is something I grapple with in this story, is that there's a plethora of choices, right? So we're not Jane, where there are maybe, there's either, you
Your
know,
governess.
St. John Rivers, you know, God help you, or there's, you know, the guy, the crazy guy with the woman in the attic. And and so, you know, Flannery in this story, my character, has what feels to me and a more typical sort of like a series of possibilities and choices that she's exploring in her, you know, young adult life. And in some ways, that's not as romantic, really. I mean, I feel so. Perhaps that's why for her, the romance is this, you know, distant, remembered relationship from when her life was simpler and when she was accessing that passion for the first time in her life.
And had less choice,
exactly.
It's interesting.
Yeah, so much of romance, like classic romance, is about feeling trapped, right?
That's
and
right.
trying to
yeah.
escape from your trapped situation. Right. I was telling these guys earlier that I think about Wuthering Heights like a weird amount, like possibly every day. And I've started like thinking about this story of, you know, what if Catherine and Heathcliff and Linton, what if Catherine and Linton were just like polyamorous? And that's like the problem solved. That's, there would be no Wuthering Heights.
Oh, but then there'd be so many new problems. You need to rewrite it.
A lot more problems. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, we have solutions in modern love that were not as prevalent.
You know, somebody mentioned writing about sex, so we can't talk about love with three novelists without talking about writing about sex, which can either be like wonderful or hysterically bad. We've all read the hysterically bad stuff, and it's great fun.
Although it's in Britain that they actually give a bad sex writing award.
I don't think
we have that here yet.
So talk about writing about sex, and I'm trying to think about these three novels and whether there's anything overt in any of them, but in your lives as writers, talk about that.
I have taught actually a sex writing class because I find that there people tend to avoid something that is so, it's the reason why most of us are here, I think. I think that's how it works. But it does seem to me that that's such a private, the child must leave the room first. Sorry. I mean, it's just, I can't, especially I write domestic drama, and that for me, the definition of domestic drama is people in confined spaces and the way that encourages or limits intimacy of all kinds. And I think you can't write domestic drama now without writing about our sexual lives. And I don't want just to have naked people on the page because that's fun, although it is fun. I want to read sex scenes that progress the story and deepen our understanding of these people and how they're connecting or disconnecting. My first novel, California, I remember Seth Fisher, he interviewed me for The Rumpus, and he said something funny like, you know, I went to UC Santa Cruz and I learned to be really politically correct. And then this husband is like describing his wife in these like very sexual terms that just doesn't seem like very politically correct. And I was like, well, I don't know what happens to you when you have sex, but I feel like that stuff is present. You are always you bring all the history of your sociological history into the bedroom, of course. And then other times that falls away and you're just beasts again. And I'm interested in that. And this book, I had a really fun time thinking about, you know, Lady, not to give too much away, but she finds an old lover and she's basically wrecking her life. And I was interested in what would that sex be like now, knowing one that you're doing it for destructive purposes, and would you realize how different you are 20 years later? And then there's another relationship between S and Lady's son, and he doesn't speak, and she's not herself. So what is that sex life? What do we learn about these people through their intimate moments? I think not only is it entertaining to read sex scenes, it also enlarges our understanding of these people.
Yeah, it's so important in literary fiction in particular to make sure that a sex scene actually deepens one's understanding of the character. I mean, no one needs a play-by-play, really, not in literary fiction.
Well,
some people need it. But, like, the reader isn't there for the play-by-play. They're there to understand something more about your character. And if your sex scene can do that, then that's what it needs to do.
I'm curious, you said something, Eden, about, I was thinking about these characters and what they brought to the situation. I'm thinking about backstory. Mm-hmm. So when you're writing a novel, you're thinking a lot, who are these people and who were they before? And I'm curious about what doesn't make it to the page and that process. So Anybody?
Well, that's a question I think about often when I'm writing, because and as I say, so this novel, I often have the experience of learning as I write the novel what the novel is really about, and, or you think it's going to be a novel largely about this, and then you realize there are all these other issues and conflicts that are surfacing. So these two women are at turning points in their lives and needing to move forward. And at the point I was writing the novel, or first writing the novel, I was, you know, as it happens, also at a moment of you know, a kind of a fissure was ahead of me, and a different change before I moved forward. And so one of the things that meant for me as a writer was that I kept looking back, and I kept thinking about the things that had been happening to them. And so I had this authorial conflict of wanting to get them forward, but needing to understand where they'd been. And so I eventually found the way of describing where they had been to get to the point where they are re-encountering one another. But there's definitely quite, you know, material on the cutting room floor when I realized that we had to maintain the forward motion. You know, mm-hmm. as fascinated as I was about all the decisions they had already moved through.
And Shanti, you had a lot of backstory. I mean, you had a novel that starts in a different country, essentially, and a journey, and you probably had to make a lot of decisions about that, too.
Yeah, I had to do a lot of shuffling. So when I wrote this book, I wrote it from, like, the first steps of Soli's journey up completely chronologically to the end. And then in subsequent drafts, I did a lot of shuffling chronologically, so I had to cut some stuff out. I think what ended up in the book is really all that needed to be there. But, you know, there is stuff from my other characters' pasts, from Rishi and Kavya's pasts, that I, you know, for me, made them a fuller character. So there was this whole thing about Kavya, she was a student at Berkeley, you know, she was an activist. This whole thing about how she would like just like hang out on Sproul Plaza in Berkeley and do all these activist things that no other South Asian students that she knew were doing. And with Rishi, with this whole journey with his career, so there's stuff that I think still informs her character. Somehow it leaks from deleted backstory into mm-hmm. what you actually get, I think. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think in revision there's two kinds of writer, not always, but I guess each project is either the revision process is either adding or taking away. Mine seem to always be adding. I'm like very lean, and then I'm like, I gotta go back and add some more stuff. But I do think that's sometimes helpful when you're thinking about your work, is like, do I need to elaborate here, or can I shave down a little bit?
I want to get back for a moment to the idea of the contemporary novel versus the traditional novel again. And I'm just going to ask this because this is something I, as a reader, have always wanted to know. So you have these traditional classic heroines who are often trapped, as you said, mm-hmm. and they want to communicate with someone, and a letter takes weeks and weeks to reach them. You know, you have the stuff going back and forth. You know what I'm going to ask, between Jane and Rochester. And here we are now with a much different way of communicating. And we have texts, and we have, you know, it's instantaneous. And I just think about, I know how that's changed detective stories, for example, which I've just recently come to love, and boy, is that rich. But how much it's changed the way the process unfolds, and the pace, and the speed with which people get and react to information. So is that something you think about at all as you're working?
I mean, also related to that, I just have to say it's very difficult to have secrets now, and most of the great novels, secrecy is, you know, or information that you don't have access to is so important.
Or the reader knows, and the characters
right.
don't.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, probably Jane could Google, you know, Rochester, and it's like, turns out he was married. You know?
Yeah.
When's she going to get around to telling her that, you know? So there are just so many things that don't work. You have to find... other solutions to it. Mystery is obviously a great heart in drama or in romance for that matter. But I did struggle that with these characters. You know, how much would they have Googled one another? Google, you know, plays a role in my book because I had to deal with the fact that I couldn't pretend that they just like, gosh, I wonder whatever happened to her. You know, it's like, you know, the question is answered a minute later.
I almost Googled, it was the Claire Massoud novel, and I was thinking, mm-hmm. what was that again? Mm-hmm. But I thought that would have been unseemly.
I think the novelist's role now and then is the same, and that is to, you have to treat, for me, narrative is about the treatment of time on the page. You have to show the then and the before and the after and the now and the later, and that's still the same, although, as you say, our conception of time is different mm-hmm. because things are so much faster. Because my first book, California, didn't have any technology at all, I actually wanted to write a book that was about, that had the internet. I wanted to write a deeply contemporary novel, one that had Twitter and had like mentions of bikini waxes and Tevas and all the things that some of us know about. I just wanted it to feel very now because that's the life that I lead. So when I decided to put in texts and emails and Craigslist and Twitter, the challenge for me was how can this play a role in the plot? Because usually that stuff just kills plot because we find the answers. But how can it actually how can it hide information and reveal information in a way that's dramatic? So that was my idea. So I have somebody set up a secret Twitter account in the beginning, and it's like the Chekhovian gun. That is going to go off at the end. You are going to find out about that Twitter account, and it's going to have something happen with the plot. So that was actually really fun for me because I was so starved for that with my first novel. Mm-hmm. So now I'm writing another novel that has no technology again because I'm over that for now. But I do think it's a good challenge for us to write about our contemporary lives and to really think about how technology has changed not only our understanding of time, but also how we have changed, how it has changed our understanding of going on vacation, for instance. Oh, stop here, gotta take a picture. You know, that stuff has really altered our everyday experience, and I wanted to make sure that was part of my book.
Yeah. And I remember in your book, in Woman Number 17, so this woman has a secret Twitter account,
as we all do, like,
but she's being publicly secret.
Yeah, she didn't make it private. She just has like a fake name.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I think of, you know, I think of that those scenes from Pride and Prejudice where the Bennet sisters, where is it, Jane Bennet is waiting for Mr. Sunshine Rainbows
Bingley.
Yeah, waiting for Bingley to write her back, and they'd, you know, the messenger would come every day and they'd like wait for their letter to be dropped in their lap, and it doesn't happen. But that still happens.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just faster. It's just faster that guys don't text you that.
You have those three dots and then they disappear.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's another sort of technology reference moment when these two women meet again, and one of them, Anne, learns that Flannery has had a daughter, and so Flannery immediately gets her phone out to show pictures, and Anne doesn't, you know, she wants to hear about about Willa first. She just, I'll look at the pictures in a minute. Just tell me.
Sean, I was going to say, in your book, you have Rishi. Mm-hmm. He's working. Can you talk a little bit about his
Rishi
job?
In
I feel
my
like
book.
That's related to our contemporary age. And
yeah, so Rishi works for this like this company, the Silicon Valley company that I made up. It's called Weebies. And it's a company that's kind of a mix of Amazon and social media, but all around children's products and parenting. And yeah,
he's like obsessed with like clean air.
Oh yeah, and clean air, and
I don't know. It's a way to bring in like the contemporary technology.
Right. Yeah,
into
contemporary
this very age-old question of parenting. I guess.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah. See, mm-hmm. I did that
good
for
job.
You, Sean.
Yeah, thanks. So I want to ask a question about process because I know people are probably curious about that. But before we do, I'd love to hear if each of you have a favorite novel that deals with a love theme, either classic or contemporary, that we haven't talked about yet, that you want to sort of point to as something that's inspired you or that you just love and return to again and again.
Really putting us on the spot.
Yeah, I am. I'll just say while you're thinking, reading Madame Bovary when you're 17 and then reading it again when you're 45 and then even reading it again when you're 60, I mean, different books are different, as we know, at different times in our lives, so...
I had an interesting relation with an earlier novel by Julian Barnes, who I think writes beautifully about love and about loss and grieving somebody whom you've loved. And Sense of an Ending certainly is a beautiful novel about love and change. But he wrote an early book called Talking It Over with these three characters, essentially a love triangle. And it irritated me so much. The guy who I hated got the woman, and it just bothered me so much. I really felt sorry for the nice guy who kind of got left in the dust in that story. But I couldn't forget that story. It's really stayed with me. And then he, in due course, wrote a sequel called Love, Etc., where he revisited those characters. And I think the fact that he did that with those, with that triangle of characters, is probably was in the back of my mind when I decided to come back to the two people from my earlier novels. So I think those are, that's an interesting pair of his books.
Anybody else?
I always go to Wuthering Heights, but we already talked about that. So maybe my second favorite, you know, sort of classic novel is The Great Gatsby, and the love there. And I reread that maybe a year or two ago, and I was just struck in a way that I hadn't been before by the sadness of the writing itself. The prose itself is just sort of so like weighed down and melancholy, not in a heavy plotting way, but in a way that shows that the writer himself, Fitzgerald, had come to a point in his life where he'd been through all the glitz and glamour. You know, he was a little older. He felt the regret and the loss and the beauty that comes with that in love.
Mm-hmm. And with him in particular, his own, as you said, personal biography and Zelda, you can't not think about that when you're reading that, for sure.
The book that just came to me is Stoner by John Williams,
yes.
Which is not about a stoner.
Yes.
It's about a man. It's just a very simple story about this man's life and how he grew up on a farm and then goes to college and falls in love with literature and becomes an English professor. And he's in this bad marriage, to put it lightly, and he has this very loving affair, but what really I remember is his love for language, and when he reads, I think, a Shakespeare sonnet for the first time, and he has this sort of revelation in the classroom that is still very moving to me, and it's an interesting book because I would say in some ways it is about love. It's about a love for books and a love that is that can't last, and the love he has for his daughter that's kind of taken from him by his evil wife. What persists for me is this image of this one man and sort of his movement through the world, and I feel so much love for him that when my husband, we have this famous story in our marriage where my husband's reading this book, and then one day I come in the room and my husband is like sobbing at the edge of the bed, and I was like, oh my God, what happened? And he was like, I finished Stoner. And then I was like, oh, I see why you're crying. He was just like sobbing, and that book could bring that feeling, like that is true love there.
It's a beautiful book, and the title is deceptive. It is not about a stoner, just so you know. And it's a very spare book.
I mean, he covers his whole life, and it's only about 200 pages, and the prose is kind of crisp.
Remind me the
heartbreak.
The author,
John Williams,
Stoner.
That's another problem, is that he has the same name as four other people, the composer. And
The History of Love.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
That is a good one. So we're going to go to audience questions in a moment, or comments. But before we do, I'd like each of you to talk a little bit about your process, because I always find in a group like this, some of us are wannabe writers, maybe many of us, and we want to know how you do it, because you obviously do it well, and you've got publishers, and people read your books, and you're fabulous. So starting with Shanti, do you want to talk a little bit about your process?
Yeah, so my process with Lucky Boy in particular was just to write whenever I could. I mean, I sleep as much as I can because I have two kids, so I don't wake up at 5 in the morning like some people do to write every day. With this book, it grew very slowly, and I was able to devote maybe one day a week, one full day a week to writing it. And at a certain point, when you get into a project, you're able to write anywhere, anytime. But for a long time, I just had that one day, and I gave it my all on, like, Wednesdays. And that's how this very slowly grew, and there was a lot of research, and it just took forever.
Were you thinking about it? I'm sure you were on those other days, and just kind of dying to get back to it. I mean, when you sat down on that Wednesday, was it like, whoa?
You know, and for me, that tension is important, where writing is a thing that I get to do. It's not the thing that I have to do when I sit at my desk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Eden?
My writing is dictated by childcare. So for this book, right now I have 3 days a week to write. And I'm very good at compartmentalizing. So I've never, even before I get to, I never was like, I just wrote for 10 hours straight and my hair's all crazy and I've been drinking whiskey, but I finished my draft. I've been like, now I'm going to sit down. Here's my coffee. I'm going to write for 2.5 hours. Done. Now I'm going to go to the doctor. I've always been able to put that time, and Stephen King, I don't know why you're writing on your birthday or Christmas. You should be taking those days off. So I like to write for a few hours. I turn off the internet.
Yeah.
I listen to music when I write, with music with lyrics, which people find very weird. But I need music to kind of get into an emotive space. And then when writing's going well, I don't even notice the music's on. I'll just listen to the same album or the same mix of songs like 8 times in a row. When the writing isn't going well, I spend a lot of the time trying to find the right music. And I write directly on the computer. I don't do much research, actually. Even for my first novel that takes place at the end of the world, and I don't even go camping. I just like to deeply imagine. So what I'll tend to do, I mean, for this book, I took a speech therapist out for coffee, and she gave me some, we talked about it for a long time, and then I looked at a few websites that she recommended. And then I just really tried to, as much as I can, get into the perspective of my characters. I like to write on the computer and then stop and write by hand a little bit. Not the actual text, but I like to write by hand what I've just written. So I'll write the scene or whatever, and then I'll go to my notebook and write, okay, so this just happened, and I think maybe I'll have this happen, and these are the ideas I'm thinking about. And I just do that 3 times a week.
Well, this is the first time I've ever written a sequel. So it's the first time I've had the characters. I already knew who the characters were when they started out. And because the first novel is generated more response from readers than other fictions of mine, I'd had in mind the idea of writing a sequel to that novel for quite a long time. So people were, whatever happened to Anne of Cleves? Do they get together again? Do they meet again? What happens? So actually, a couple of years before I started this book, I had a concept of what happened to the two characters, and this has happened to me occasionally, where I essentially wrote the novel in my head. I really didn't write any on paper, but I would take walks, and I just planned out a whole plot. And then I came to the end of it, and I thought, that's wrong. That's not what happened to these two people at all. I can't tell that story. So then I put it aside, and I think that's probably when I wrote my children's book, and then I came back to it. So this, in uniquely for me, was a story where I knew this story was there for me to write and to discover, and it finally was the point in my life when I was able to do that. And then in terms of the process writing, I do try to write every day for the first draft. I mean, you know, sort of, I take breaks. I don't work at Christmas or my birthday, but I do try to get a pretty regular writing rhythm in for the draft. But this had a lot of, as I say, a lot of rewriting and wrangling and editing to pull it into the right shape.
I do think there's so much that happens away from the desk,
daydreaming
quality of marinating all the time.
Walking for me, walking is a crucial part of writing,
and having a notebook by your bed. Mm-hmm. So when you wake up at 3 a.m, you can write down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's your turn, and we'd love to hear from you, not necessarily just a question, but a comment. There's a hand in the back. Thank you for being the first.
Hi. So going back to the theme of the ferocity of love, probably the most fierce and unconditional love I've ever experienced is through friends. Mm-hmm. And it's very much different than a romantic partnership, which, you know, boyfriends come and go, but girlfriends are forever, that sort of attitude. I was wondering if there is a particular book or a quote or anything like that that you refer to when you're writing about really intense platonic, like non-romantic relationships between peers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Woman Number 17 has a female friendship, and that is one of those, I agree, one of those really seminal relationships in my life have been with my friends. I love the, I mean, this is sort of obvious, but I love Elena Ferrante's Neapolitan Quartet. Is it a quartet? Mm-hmm. Those are great, and they're sort of like these very, I don't have to go like this, like Italian, fraught, but beautiful, passionate relationship between two friends and all the good and the bad that comes between those women. I love them.
It's a great subject in fiction. Dana Spiata is a writer who has a recent novel called The Innocence.
Yes. That's very Innocence and Others.
Yes. Innocence and Others. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great book.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a great description of female friendship.
That is two. Oh, thank you for mentioning both of these. Mm-hmm. Just love those. There's a question here.
Shanti, how did you figure out how to get someone out of Mexico into Berkeley? I mean, how would you know how to figure out how to do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I, first of all, did a lot of research into how people do get from Mexico across the where did I get my research from? From personal testimonies, like oral histories. There are a few anthologies out there that detail the lives and the experiences of people who are undocumented in the U.S. And there are some good documentaries about, you know, the freight trains that come up through Mexico. It's how a lot of people travel north through the country on top of the freight train, sort of hanging on for dear life. I used a lot of research in that way. I spoke to immigration lawyers, immigration policy experts about, you know, what it's like to actually have to make that crossing, even just the physical border crossing, is its own thing and is very different from the journey itself. Mm-hmm. Just relying on the expertise and generosity of others and writing that is nonfiction and already out there. Yeah.
I think there's a classic story of love, Sense and Sensibility. Mm-hmm. And do you know that there's a card game, Marrying Mr. Darby? Did you know that?
No.
And I just spent 2 years in Korea, and that was one of the most popular card games, was Marrying Mr. Darby. And the people who request it are the men. Men like to play Marrying Mr. Darby. So any thoughts about your books becoming a card game, and what would that be like?
Wow,
that's a great question. Well, I think mine would definitely have to be some kind of drinking game, because there's a lot of alcoholism.
Is.
So there have to be like something where it happens and you have to drink, and maybe like drink and like have you ever like truth telling and drinking combined.
My daughter,
it's dangerous.
At this moment, is home making a board game and I about for an English assignment, and I thought it was going to be about Lord of the Flies, which seemed challenging.
Uh-oh.
But in fact, it's about a science fiction novel called Four. So,
my game would be sort of like maybe something like Chutes and Ladders.
Yes, yeah.
But there'd be some thing in the middle that like the two players were both trying to get. There'd be some sleight of hand. There'd be some like secrecy. There'd be a lot of luck involved. Yeah.
What a great question. I love that.
Oh, you're holding. I was going to ask you about how you combine reading fiction with writing. Do you like stop reading once you write a novel, or do you complement the two, or what's the... Mm-hmm.
I don't really, I'm always writing, so I don't understand people who don't read while they're writing. I'd be like, that's like 3 years without reading a book. What are you going to do? So I'm always reading. I tend to avoid things that seem content-wise kind of similar to my project. So when I was writing California, I avoided all post-apocalyptic narratives, but I was interested in narratives that had like a twist in the middle. So books like Gone Girl were really instructive for that. Mm-hmm. This book, I had actually read a lot of the books that I had read, Woman Upstairs, I had read Department of Speculation, a lot of books that are some of my favorite books, like Notes on a Scandal by Zoe Heller. Mm-hmm. They're sort of like my fairy godmother books. Mm-hmm. So I've already read those, but I was interested in, I would avoid any books that had like female friendship or whatever going on, the nanny books or something. But I could read, the Woman Number 17 is two first-person narrators, so I'm off the top of my head, I can't think of one. But I did sometimes seek out things that were formally similar, because I find that really helpful to be like, these are two first-person narrators talking about farm life in the 1800s. You know, that's not going to feel like I'm taking that material, but I am learning about how to tell this kind of story.
That's
Yeah, I feel like I'm constantly learning from other people's writing. You know, in some sense, there are voices that are very different than mine that sort of wake mine up a little bit. Mm-hmm. I remember early in this book, I was reading Juno Diaz, and, you know, he's a very exciting writer, and I had to, there were certain passages where I clearly was just trying to sound like Juno Diaz, and I had to, in the end, go back and make sure that they sounded like me instead. But I did also, in later drafts, really sort of sit down and very studiously go through Beloved by Toni Morrison, because she does great things seamlessly with memory and time and jumping back and forth in time.
Did you have a question?
Hold on, let the microphone come so everyone can hear it.
Who's got the question?
Did you read The Leavers by Lisa
Coe?
Yeah.
I have it at home. I'm starting it.
What's it called?
The Leavers by Lisa Coe. It's just come out like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I've read both of yours.
Oh, great.
Yeah, like them both.
Similar themes with undocumented immigration.
You'll probably be on a panel with her someday.
So I think I might be.
I would say if you didn't take notes today, there's been a wonderful bibliography. Yes, I mean, everything that's been mentioned, and some I forgot, so I was happy to hear about. I love the Dana Spiota and Elena Ferrante. I mean, come on. So here's the story. All of these books are available for sale in the courtyard. Our esteemed authors will be signing the books. I want to apologize to Sylvia for screwing up the title of her new book, which is a sequel, and it is called Pages for Her. The earlier one is Pages for You. And I just, this is so great to have you all here, and the questions are just so good and so provocative. So thanks so much to all of you, but most of all, thanks to you for being here and writing your book. Terrific conversation. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.